Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Welcome, welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. The solar wind is back down to a mild 389 kilometers per second, down from last week's scorching 650 kilometers per second. We don't know what's going on, but the sun got quiet all of a sudden. There were several sunspots last week, but departing sunspot 1069 is the one crackling with solar flares. Just yesterday, it erupted more than half a dozen times. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory, the SDO, video recorded each of the explosions with a clarity 10 times better than HDTV. If you haven't been to the new site, you need to make a visit. We are in for a very intense solar summer. Also, beginning on the 10th of May, you will be able to see the International Space Station coming over the eastern part of the United States between 8 p.m. and 11 p.m., and it's going to be coming out of the north, so very easy to see, and it's finally where you don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get outside to see it. You'll be able to catch it sometimes twice an evening up until the 17th, so that's from tomorrow, the 10th, until the 17th. So if you haven't seen it, or your friends haven't seen the International Space Station, they're not looking up. Take them outside tomorrow night with something to do and crane your neck and look to the north, and you'll see something amazing. With the Euro facing the stiffest test since its debut in 1999, the weekend turned into a crisis management exercise to restore faith in the currency and prevent a European debt crisis from cascading around the world. With the financial architects working hard, we wonder if they'll make use of this opportunity to push for a global currency. We will see when the European markets open in a few hours. The bond vigilantes are swarming for billion-dollar bargains. By the way, if you ever wondered about getting your cash out of the bank, you shouldn't wonder anymore. There were 45 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, four of them over 5.0. They're spread out everywhere still. The earth is ringing like a bell. We don't really know what's going to pop out of it, but a lot of tremors around the world in diverse places. Also, the new book, Remembering the Future, is available in ebook format right now. Only 50 days left until it comes out in print, but you can read it now and get a 25% discount on the printed version by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com. rememberingthefuturebook.com. You can pick up the ebook for $7.95. All is not wasted, though. You will not only get to read the book, but that 25% discount off the autographed version when it comes out will be yours on the library while you're still digesting the information therein. And don't forget, Twitter is now alive and well on X Squared Radio. I add stuff pretty much every day. There's been a lot of excitement in the last 24 hours, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. It is exciting to see that we can share our consciousness almost on a real-time basis around the planet. And if you have a cell phone or an iPod or an iPhone, there's always a way to stay in touch with the latest things that are happening around the planet. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. It's a short 30-minute version, and the more you click, the more your friends click, the better our chances are of syndication. That means that we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word. You know, I have heard it said of late, even though we have great respect for the 800-pound gorilla that airs from midnight on the West Coast, or 11 o'clock on the West Coast, over 695 AM radio stations. The word is, there has been no alternative until now. And that's what this program is all about. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Oh, you better have your seatbelt on tight tonight. Here we go. While many of us are reading books, watching documentaries, maybe occasionally joining a group and going to a strange place on the earth to look for mysteries, or listening to X-Squared Radio, some are out there with heavy equipment and special technology, searching beneath the ground for the ancient secrets left behind by who knows who. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Mysteries being uncovered. Those of you that listen to X Squared Radio regularly or happen to be one of our many, many thousands of friends on Facebook, you know all about it. But those of you that are listening live are going to hear maybe for the first time. It's okay. Less than 24 hours has gone by since the news was made exclusively right here on X Squared Radio. Before we get to that, you know, there are some very strange earth changes occurring. Many people look at the accident down in the Gulf of Mexico as just some operator error. You know, somebody made a mistake, stayed up too late, or the supply ship brought too many beers or something to the platform. But the deadly blowout of the oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico was triggered by a bubble of methane gas that escaped from the well and shot up the drill column, expanding quickly as it burst through several seals and barriers before exploding, according to interviews with rig workers conducted through British Petroleum's internal investigation. Now, the interesting thing about this, these guys run into high-pressure pockets of methane all the time during regular drilling. But this was different. This was a surprise. This was something the Earth delivered to technology, and it surprised them, and it blew the rig up. Now, also, efforts to cap this leak, by the way, they just thought if they didn't talk about it for a few days, it might go away, and here we are 17 days into it, and several hundred thousand barrels of oil headed for the most pristine beaches on the southern part of the United States, and some efforts have been made to cap it. Yesterday, many of you saw the video go out of the giant, it looks like a giant metal can that they're lowering down 5,000 feet, very carefully, by the way. That's not really smooth water in the Gulf of Mexico, especially a mile deep. There are all kinds of currents flowing through there. So you can imagine having a 100-ton metal can from a cable beneath the boat. Just about anything can happen. Well, sure enough, ice-like crystals encrusted the 100-ton steel and concrete box meant to contain the oil gushing from the broken well deep in the Gulf of Mexico. The interesting thing is the buildup on the specially constructed containment box made it too buoyant, and it clogged it up. BP Chief Operating Officer Douglas Suttle said, So methane from inside the earth blew the well up, and ice from the sea stopped the efforts to cap the leak. What else is going on down there? Sounds like the earth has a different idea. I would really like to see an alternative to oil, and we'll talk about that a lot in this program during the year. Hey, early this morning, and I mean early this morning on the eastern seaboard here, I received daytime photos of the mysterious shaft being dug to loot the chambers beneath the Sphinx. Now, if you want to see the photos, there are 20 of them that have rocked the world since 2:30 this morning, Eastern Standard Time. All you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the YouTube. You can go to YouTube and you can search for Egypt Shaft Sphinx, and it'll pull up. And I want you to share this YouTube and send it around the world, because the whole world needs to know that the Hall of Records beneath the Sphinx is being looted. That might even be sold off to private collections. I'll bet the owners of that information are pretty angry right now. So tonight, I would like to hear your thoughts on what you think might be buried beneath the right paw of the Sphinx. While we're talking about it, items are being crated up and hauled off from a 24 by 24 shaft, not 150 feet from the Sphinx. Now, there have been a lot of prognosticators, not the least of which is Edgar Cayce. ARE is the organization set up in his legacy. They do a wonderful job in publishing his works and in helping others who have like-minded ideas. I think you may have heard, if you have your ear to the ground out there, somebody saying ARE was saying nothing was going on in front of the Sphinx. I have it officially, that is not true. It's just somebody saying that ARE is saying that nothing officially is going on in front of the Sphinx. That it's all part of the Red Bull BMX sports event. And by the way, pictures of that event are also in that YouTube if you'd like to go look at it. You can clearly see that there is a YouTube event being built, lots of ramps and scaffolding and chairs and lights and wonderful things like that. But there's another dig going on very close by. I can tell you, I was there. I have friends that are there. I have a trusted source, absolutely impeccable credentials and integrity. There is another dig. Actually, there are two other digs going on, and we're going to talk about those tonight. So if you want to be part of the program, you can call in. It's 415-762-1161. Anywhere, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 415-762-1161. In the early 1800s, many, I'm going to call them expeditions. I won't even call them archaeological expeditions, because archaeology really officially didn't become a science until about 1857. Prior to that, there were wealthy aristocrats who, in expansion of the British Empire or different French or German expeditions to Egypt and areas around about, were basically collectors, okay? They used dynamite, they used horses and mules and what was modern technology in those days to open these, what they called tombs, and literally take the stuff and take it home and put it in their private collections. This was the exclusivity that wealth and arrogance afforded these people. Fortunately, with the establishment of the science of archaeology, the study of these ancient things, a lot of that came to an end, because there were protocols put in place, there were ways of not disturbing the site, there were ways of dating it, looking at the tooling and the pottery and different things that might tell us about the language and the purpose and function of their society. And fortunately, I guess in the next 100 years, from 1857 until 1957, a lot of the looting was stopped, and museums sprang up around the world. Now, the greatest museums in the world, of course, Alexandria was burnt to the ground, but other museums, like the museum in Cairo, or the British Museum in London, or the Smithsonian Institution. I mean, there are lots of places. One place I highly recommend, it's accessible to everyone, it's very inexpensive to go to, and that is the Museum of Anthropology at Mexico City. That is one you never want to miss. If you live in the United States, you have no excuse not to make your way down there and see that amazing, amazing museum. You'll see things there that will change your view of what you thought maybe were primitive people living in the Yucatan and Mexico. That being said, officially, I'm not saying that these are private expeditions. There have been many, many attempts using radar, using various seismic methods to try to discover tombs and hidden treasures in and around Egypt. If you've ever been there, you'll understand what I'm talking about. If you haven't been there, I'm sure you have heard people talk about Egypt. Not many natural resources in Egypt. It doesn't have a lot of water, although the Nile runs through it. It doesn't have a lot of oil. It doesn't have any forests. It doesn't have any ability to produce hardly anything except for technology. And it happens to be the home of some of the most amazing antiquities on planet Earth. Now, this takes a special caretaker, takes a special responsibility to be a member of the human race on the Earth, in this, the 21st century, and to be able to look back in time 1,000, 5,000, perhaps 10,000 years, there is a certain responsibility. There is a certain call of integrity that goes out with this inheritance of these great civilizations. One need only sit at the base, or walk through it, or fly over it, or see a halfway decent documentary of it, and you will realize that these civilizations not only were very highly technically advanced in tooling, in engineering, in project management, but they had an understanding of the relationship of the Earth to the rest of the galaxy. They had an understanding of the Earth in relation to the Sun, other specific stars, such as Sirius. They had an understanding of the curvature of the Earth, of the movement of the seasons, and even of the tilting of the Earth on its axis, to such a precise degree that nothing in rope or chain could ever explain it. I have been told up until last year by officials that Egyptians didn't even have the wheel. They didn't even have iron tools. They maybe had mastered the art of using copper as a tool. I don't know if you've ever used copper as a tool. But it's a little like trying to hammer in a 16-penny nail through a pine board using a banana. You go through a lot of bananas. You go through a lot of copper doing that. This was reported to the world as the Bronze Age. Now, bronze is a nice heavy metal that you can make statues out of. Maybe you can make a sword out of it that works against flesh, but it doesn't work against another sword. It's also awfully heavy to carry around. Now, that being said, the great copper deposits aren't in Egypt. They happen to be, at least in those days, in Michigan. Yes, that's right, Michigan, the United States, Michigan. Many people don't know this, but over 500,000 tons, half a million tons of copper were removed from a mine in Michigan that's 25,000 years old. And by the way, there are no roads. There's no evidence of any towns. There are hardly any tools left, a few engines, a few carts. There weren't any major rivers coming to the area, and this was a particular kind of copper. It wasn't like copper you find anywhere else on the planet. This was a very pure copper. This was the kind of copper that shines to a brightness that defies definition. And it has been seen, even in colonial times, tools and artifacts made of this copper were popping up here and there. It stuck out. It was something that really turned your eye when you looked at it. You said, holy cow, where in the world did you get that shiny thing? Oh, we got it up there in the area we know today as Michigan. But Earth explorers, the only way to get that much copper out of that area in those days was by air. And we want to know, and still have no answer to the question, where did the copper go? Yes, maybe this was a little, quite a bit before the Bronze Age, but that copper didn't show up anywhere. Here and there, a small sample, a little bar, a little trinket, a little knife blade, but not 500,000 tons of copper. It's gone. It was taken somewhere. Now, when you look at the age of these edifices in Egypt, now, I'm not talking about Saqqara. Saqqara is a pile of mud compared to the Great Pyramid in Egypt. And the Great Pyramid in Egypt is an engineering project that defies today's organizational skills. To put a little over 1.4 million blocks plus multi-dozen ton black granite blocks in precise locations, so tightly you cannot fit a piece of paper between them, high up inside that pyramid, with faces so smooth that you can run your hand over them and barely feel the texture of the granite. Arranged in such a way to make a chamber, this, and we call it the King's Chamber. For a century, it was thought to be a tomb. For another half century, they really didn't know. Now we understand that this was sort of like a dream chamber, sort of like an awakening chamber. It was arranged so that resonant frequencies from the earth could be amplified and focused on a single spot. And that single spot was a container, which up until just a few years ago, we kept calling the sarcophagus. No one was ever buried in it. It wasn't a sarcophagus. It was a thinking chamber. It was a place where you faced your fears. It was a place where you overcame and you became initiated into a higher order of understanding, a link with the universe, with the earth. And I have to tell you, if you lay in that, you're going to feel an energy like nothing you've ever felt, unless you've been stuck in the state of hypnagogia for quite a long time, which is a little difficult for the untrained to do. Hypnagogia is the state between sleep and wakefulness. It's the place at which the subconscious rubs up against the conscious mind. Ideas seem to be able to go freely back and forth, although not with very good frames of reference. In other words, some of the things that you are exposed to in your subconscious don't make any sense to the conscious mind because their frame of reference, their icons, their comparisons, their analogs are different than the conscious mind. They also move at incredible speed. Nevertheless, this sarcophagus was a place where the energy of the pyramid could be focused, reflected off a series of layers of granite that were placed in precise points exactly corresponding to a Fibonacci spiral leading out of the sarcophagus, but only in the male direction. If you went in the female direction, the spiral would come around and land on top of the granite reflectors above you. There are several of them. I believe there are five. There may be four. I don't have the blueprints in front of me right now. The top of these are not smooth. They're rough. They're made to absorb the energy. The bottom, however, is polished flat. They're made to reflect the energy. So what happens is the energy that reflects off of the earth is focused, amplified, resonated right back to that dream chamber, that thought chamber, the area, that the specific spot that you would lay inside of a granite box with or without a lid. It's hard to tell now. There have been so many millions of people in and out of that thing. A piece of the side of it is broken out. I do not know if there was ever a lid for that. I am told that there is a ritual where an individual might be placed inside of that, the lid put on it, and then you're left for 3 days. At the end of the third day, you rise. Does that story sound familiar? Lay in the tomb for 3 days and rise on the third day? Yeah, the story's been around for thousands of years before it got recorded in the New Testament. The idea is that there is a threshold. There is a a gateway, a stargate, as you will, that you pass through and gain special knowledge. You overcome these fears. You gain a perspective high above what mortality can deliver to you. Now, the most important thing you need to realize, if you ever visit there, is that that chamber, that granite box, is not in the original position. It isn't in the original position. It has been moved because the focus of the energy resonating off of those granite reflectors was too much for the uninitiated, for the untrained, for those who were not ready to experience the real power of what that specific spot could deliver. And so it has been moved. Now, it's still significant, especially to the unseasoned, but it is not in the precise position that it originally was. Once you understand the use of, the benefit of this chamber, you gain a new respect for the ancients that originally built the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Now, the reason that the Great Pyramid of Egypt looks differently than the other pyramids is because, and make no mistake about this, it was the first pyramid. And that pyramid was there in Egypt long before the Egyptians ever got there. But something even more amazing, on the same plateau, just a few hundred yards away, was the Sphinx. Now the Sphinx was a different structure altogether. Oh, I've seen the documentaries, as you have. Sure, it was carved from top to bottom. It was hewn out of a form that was already there. And some say it had the head of Anubis on it, some say it had the head of a lion on it, and some vain pharaoh some years later decided to carve it in his own likeness. Because, after all, everything preceding them was of no value. They were now the living God on earth, and they could do what they wanted to do. That structure, the Sphinx, once the corrosion, the erosion on the side of it, was revealed as damage left behind by standing water, it really rocked the world. Then and only then did we understand how old the Sphinx might be. Not at the beginning of the Egyptian dynasty. Long before Egypt was even Egypt, long before Egyptus ever came to the Nile Valley, was the Sphinx. Who built the Sphinx? And I can tell you this, they didn't build it in the middle of the desert. That was a lush green paradise in those days. We're not talking 3,000 or 4,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 years ago. No, we're talking 11,500 years ago. 11,500 years ago, long before Egypt was Egypt. That is when these valuables were placed in the chambers beneath the Sphinx. They may have been added to over the centuries, but I can tell you, as a year ago this last January, I'm sorry, 2 years ago this last January, the bottom of the Sphinx was full of water. I know this. I was there. I have photographs myself of the back grate being taken off of what would be the hind quarter of the Sphinx, and an individual hopped down in there. It was about 10 feet deep. He didn't walk 6 yards, and he faced water. The water table was very, very high in those days. Now, this was January, which is the Egyptian winter. Oh, it was a frosty 55 degrees, which is great for a Scot like me. It's kind of interesting to see Egyptians walking around with down jackets on when it's 55 degrees. I was quite comfortable myself. But it also kept the tourists back, which allowed us to see things that you wouldn't normally see. So, what has been going on for the last few months? That's exactly right. They have been pumping water out of the bottom of this area with big pumps. Hundreds of thousands of gallons a day pumped out of that area until the water receded. And then, in the dark of night, they began to move dirt. About four stories down, they decided to dig a shaft. If you haven't seen photographs of the shaft, you can see it one of two ways. You can either go to YouTube and you can put in Giza Sphinx shaft and it will pop up. You'll find it. Or you can simply go to xsquaredradio.com, look on the front page, and there it is. We welcome your comments, but we would really appreciate it when you look at that YouTube, go down below it and click the share button and put that thing on your profile. We need to spread that video all around the world. Here's why. A few weeks ago, a nighttime video came out. Somebody filmed heavy equipment. I say heavy equipment, it's maybe light equipment, working in the dead of night in front of the Sphinx. Very difficult to see. Let me tell you why. Because when you're filming invisible light with a video camera, what the camera will pick up on are the lights, the operating lights of the equipment. This will shut the aperture down, making the rest of the picture black, which is exactly what happened. What we got were fuzzy, grainy videos, invisible light shot in the middle of the night or early morning with work lights. And you really couldn't make out any details. Then the hype and the writing and the accusations started flying. The conspiracy theories started flying. And it was about time somebody set the record straight. So my source decided to use special skills and special connections and took a risk and went in broad daylight. So what you're going to see on that YouTube, or what you're going to see on the front page of X Squared Radio, are daylight photographs of the shaft. Now, you'll notice that there's a yellow rope around this. It is cordoned off. You cross that yellow rope, you might not be a free man anymore. Also going on near the same complex is a Red Bull sports event using BMX bikes. This is going to be a big television event. Now, those of you that have been to Egypt know that on a regular basis they have a light show at the Sphinx and the pyramid. There are chairs set up and there's an outdoor venue there, and it's pretty well set up for tourists. This is not the same complex. Several hundred feet away, there's another dig. It has nothing to do with the Red Bull sports event. This is another dig, and you will clearly see this when you go watch the video. Now, the video is a slideshow. It's got some music behind it. We just wanted to make it entertaining, but the information in that video needs to be spread, because for a long time, many decades, different prognosticators, predictors, channelers, Edgar Cayce and others, have predicted that there is a chamber underneath the right paw of the Sphinx. Now, we don't really know what's in it, but it has been said that it's a hall of records. If you have read the book series, The Ark of Millions of Years, this was a series that my co-author and I started in 2001. We finished it in 2004. We published it late 2004, and by March of 2005, Volume 1 was a national bestseller. Why? Well, it was a good written book, but I think it was because millions of people are thirsty for this information. They want to know what's really going on, what's coming in 2012. How do all these things fit together? How was the Earth created? Why are we here? What is our purpose here? What is the destiny of mankind on the Earth? Well, if you read the Ark of Millions of Years series, it's about 1,500 pages, you'll have a lot better idea. There's almost 500 pictures in those three books. If you've ever published a book, you'll know how hard it is to publish a book with pictures. It's difficult. We used our skills and we got the books out, and they're very reasonably priced. They won't cost you $180 like a textbook with that many pictures in it. You'll get it very reasonable. I think it's $19, or you can even buy it cheaper than that on Amazon now. If you haven't got the book series, you can always go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, arcofmillionsofyears.com, and pick up the trilogy. We still ship them as a trilogy. They all come autographed. It's a fine bunch of reference material for your use. When we wrote it, there weren't half a dozen books out there in 2012. Now, there's about 60 or 70 new titles out on 2012. Everybody's getting into the act. So, the idea behind antiquities, ancient civilizations, and I'm not talking about ancient Egyptian civilizations, I'm talking about ancient civilizations with high technology that lived 10,000, 20,000, maybe even 50,000 years ago. These edifices were left behind as a legacy of their dynasties. And the treasures that are left in those chambers underneath, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, no more belong to the country that inherited that land than the contents of Indian burial mounds belong to the United States of America. The contents of those chambers belong to the world. And I hate to sound like Indiana Jones, but they belong in a museum, not in a private collection. There are items in that chamber, quite possibly, that mean something to this day. They are important to what we are doing in this century and why we are here, what our purpose is, what our link with these ancient civilizations might be, what kind of message would they have left for us. If you think you're coming back, you might bury your most valuable possessions in a secret place so that they'll be there when you get back. So a bunch of pesky humans who think gold is valuable won't dig into it and steal it, or worse, sell it off to the highest bidder. So it sits in some aristocrat's living room while the rest of the world wonders why we are here. The one answer, the one piece of information, the one tablet, the one face, the one cartouche, something that would put the pieces together for a researcher, are not there because they have been misappropriated. Now, I'm not saying that anyone in the Egyptian government is misappropriating anything. I'm just saying if you're having an archaeology dig, it needs to be an archaeological dig. If you look at the photograph very closely, you will see individuals standing around in some form of discussion on the site while the digging is going on. There is a front loader. There is a forklift. There are pictures of crates, some of them partially open, not quite sealed yet, but you can certainly see safe packing material on the inside of the crate. Something is being dug out by hand, crated up, and hauled away. If it is an archaeological dig, it needs to be officially called an archaeological dig, and there needs to be civilian oversight. The world needs to know where we came from, why we're here, who it was that left a message for us. Across the jungles of South America and the Yucatan, Bolivia, Peru, are secrets that we still have not discovered. Many, many millions of acres of jungle remain unexplored in this manner. There is no way to carry enough resources to go that deep into the jungle and last long enough on food and water and medicine and shelter and fight off everything, every square meter that's trying to eat you alive in order to find the secrets that are in this area. It can't be seen from the air. It's all under a thick canopy of permanent green. Out there, somewhere, is a hall of records. Out there somewhere are the answers left behind by an ancient civilization, an advanced civilization, not cave dwellers and not primitives by any stretch of the imagination. These were mathematicians. These were astronomers. These were world travelers. And if our records are right, those that are carved in the walls of Abydos, those that are left in the lower chambers below Dendera, they could fly. If you've been to the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, you can confirm this, because there, carved in the stone, are pilots sitting in their cockpits with a joystick in their hands and a helmet on their heads, flying. And we're talking 1200 BC. This information is out there. We think we are modern man. Maybe so. But there's another modern man that lived before us. And everything that we've built, whether it's out of metal or plastic, wood or drywall, asphalt, will be nothing but dust in 10,000 years. By the time the sun and the wind and the cold and the ocean and floods get to things, even the best plastics will only last about 1,000 years. Even nuclear radiation dies off after about 20, 25,000 years. Actually, the half-life is 12,500 years. So 25,000 years, theoretically, the entire resource would have decayed by then. Copper wires, antennas, roads, any kind of vehicles would have long since returned to dust and blown around like so much confetti. But buried beneath the ground, away from the sun's rays, away from the blasting summer heat, from sandstorms and windstorms and floods and cosmic radiation, things can be preserved forever. And so, embedded in coal, we have found gold chains. Embedded in stone, we have seen iron nails. Iron nails? They didn't even have iron until the Iron Age, if you want to believe the archaeologists. I think the time has come to break the mold. I think it's time to open the chambers. I think it's time the truth come out. And that's why X Squared Radio is here. And that's why our phone lines are open. 415-762-1161. In our next hour, in about 13 minutes, we are going to have the Director of Research and Exploration come on our program. His name is Rich Tellman. And he is going to talk to us about an iron spearhead. No, this is not a stone spearhead. This is not flintstone. This isn't sandstone. This isn't granite. It's not onyx. No. We're talking iron. Real iron fashioned like a spearhead. And it exists. And we've got the expert coming on to talk about it. And by the way, this is not the only thing, the only anomaly that we're going to talk about in the next hour. So stay by the phone, and you want to reach us by Skype, you can certainly do that. All you have to do is search for X2-Radio, 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 and you can send us a text if you don't want to come on the air. Although, we'll be gentle with you. You'll be able to get out there and talk to all of the listeners. And we appreciate you when you Skype in. We really do appreciate that information. We're going to ask some questions tonight, questions that there are controversial answers for, or maybe no answers at all. Some of you may have some thoughts about the answers, and we would like to hear about that. The phone number, if you want to be part of the program, is 415-762-1161. You call into the studio, they'll queue you up, and at the right moment, we'll bring you on, and we'll discuss anything. Anything you want to talk about tonight here on X Squared Radio. Tonight we're going to talk about, in great detail, the Giza Plateau and the dig into the chamber underneath the Sphinx. Some are calling it the looting of the Sphinx. You know, one of the disheartening things as civilization began to get out and be aware of these ancient antiquities is that by the time we got there with our cameras, by the time the public got there with its interest and with its love of antiquities and mysteries, looters had already gotten to it. All of the texts, copper and gold plates and ceramics and tools and bones were scattered to the four winds, gathered up as quickly as possible, and sold off on the black market. Because people have to eat. People have to get by. And if a bone here, a fragment there, a shard of pottery here, a special writing or a codex there, might be worth a dozen American dollars or a few pounds of British sterling or a few euro, it's going to go in someone's backpack and they're going to go home with it. And you would do it too. But when a government does it, when the officials get behind it and loot something, you expect someone, the international community, to step in sometime and say, hold on just a moment. This goes back well before your watch. We want to know what's going on there. We're not trying to blame anybody. It's sort of like the UFO phenomenon. You know, it would be great if somebody at NASA would just come forward and say, okay, you know, hey, we can't deny it any longer. There have been 2 million sightings this year, and yeah, okay, you got us. All right, there really is such a thing as a UFO, and we're sorry, our bad, but, you know, can we just get past this now and start understanding who we are and what our place is in the galaxy? It's sort of like that. But when a government gets involved and goes down and digs something up and crates it up and hauls it away, and you don't know where it's going, you don't know what it's going to be, you don't know, there's no oversight, there's no surety, there's no guarantee that anything is going to be taken care of, that we're going to see it someday on display, sort of like King Tut's tomb. Wasn't that marvelous? Did any of you ever get a chance to see that anywhere? My goodness, it takes your breath away when you look at the beauty of it, the power of it. It's really unbelievable. It's really something else. So we just want to make sure we're being taken care of. We want to make sure that whatever's going on out there, it's the truth. That's what we're about. We just want to know. So in our next hour, we'll have the Director of Research and Exploration, Rich Tellman, come on with us, with this great organization. And I'll let him tell you all about it. The point is that that there are people out there that care about what's going on. They really do care, and they really want to see the truth come out. They really want to see the world become educated about who we are, why we're here, what our purpose is, what our relationship with each other is. And if we could understand that a little bit better, maybe, just maybe, there's a road to peace. Maybe there's a road to learning to live as a population of earthlings instead of a bunch of nations shaking sabers at one another across the frozen abyss of misunderstanding. And maybe that's what it's about. If we could just come together on that level, if we could break the seal of secrecy and share this marvelous discovery beneath the Sphinx with the world, it might make that kind of difference. It might shift the attention of the world away from the idea that we just can't get along with one another just long enough so that our wisdom can catch up to our technology and maybe we can get out of this thing alive. So if you want to be part of the program, again, it's 415-762-1161. And next hour, we're going to take off in a more antique direction with our guest, Rich Tellman, and if we're going to bring on some other experts as well. Don't go away. Take a short break. Get a glass of water. We'll be back in about 4 minutes. Just relax. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Think about our role, why we're here on the earth, what we're doing here. Are we working just payday to payday? Are we struggling from family vacation to family vacation? Are we wondering about why it is we're here? I want you to keep something in mind, especially if you have a chance to pull up that old high school photograph of yourself and put it next to your photograph today. Just look at it, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, a couple of minutes of contemplation. What have you done from then until now? Have you wasted your time? Have you learned what you wanted to learn? Maybe not. Maybe that's why you're here at X Squared Radio tonight. I am too. And I'm glad you're here with me. My name is Brooks Agnew. This program is called X Squared Radio. This is where we explore the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. We interview guests from time to time because we like it. And if I like to interview them, then you're probably going to like listening to them too. We have a couple of items we just want to cover really quickly. Don't forget, Remembering the Future is my fourth book. This one is Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. If you're interested in such things, it's a pretty short book, a little over 200 pages. It's a good read. It will give you an idea what you can do to work the law of attraction for yourself. And you can pick it up in ebook form right now. And if you're not a big ebook fan, don't fret, because when you buy the ebook, you're going to get 25% off the printed version, which in about 50 days is coming off the presses. When it comes off, we will contact you back with a 25% off coupon, and then you'll get the autographed printed version of it to set on your shelf while the knowledge is already cooking in your head. You can use it as a reference book, share it with a friend, but you'd help us out by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and pick it up for yourself. I think you'll like it. Also, if you like the things we're talking about tonight, you can read in detail. You can see a lot of first-hand photographs taken of this stuff, and certainly some in-depth research by picking up the Arc of Millions of Years series at arcofmillionsofyears.com. The trilogy is packaged nicely and affordably. We give it to you free shipping anywhere in the United States. We also ship to Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Europe, and yes, even Japan. We are working on a Spanish translation for the book and a Chinese translation for the books, but those take some time. But if you can read English, these are the books for you. Forward Magazine called them the most comprehensive book ever written on the 2012 end times. In this hour, we're going to speak to the Director of Research and Exploration, Rich Tellman. He's going to be coming on with us in about 4 minutes. So my producer's going to call him in. We'll be back in 40 seconds with X Squared Radio. Tighten up your seatbelt, because we're getting ready to take off a little bit faster. Hey, don't forget, you can go to heavensabove.com. That's heavens-above.com. And you can find out when the International Space Station is coming over you. Starting tomorrow, between 8 and 10 p.m., actually 8 and 11 p.m., every single night for the next 10 days, you'll be able to see the International Space Station come overhead the Eastern Seaboard. If you live anywhere near Charlotte, that's between 8 and 11 p.m., and trust me, if you've never seen it go overhead, your jaw is going to drop. Take your friends out and have a look at that thing going overhead. It's amazing. It's larger than Jupiter from your perspective now. Not actually larger than Jupiter, although that would be way cool. And it goes overhead in about 3 or 4 minutes. It's very quick across the sky. So we'll get Rich on here in just a minute. My producer's working on that, and we'll bring that information to you right away. If you want to be part of the program, remember, it's 415-762-1161 anywhere, on planet or off planet. If you can get to a cell phone tower, it's 415-762-1161. I also want to reiterate our call, our open call for any UFO evidence. Any UFO evidence. I saw one. I like the I took a picture of one. But if you manage to snag one in your backyard, I'm on an airplane, okay? I'm on an airplane. If you happen to have an interaction with an off-worlder, if you can get him to come on the radio, we want to change the world right here, right now. So I'm not saying I don't believe. I'm not saying I do believe. I'm a scientist. Those of you that have been listening to this program for 5 years know that. Belief is not part of the equation. We want evidence. We want proof. And if we can give the world proof, we start shifting the mean consciousness of the human race. And that changes everything. No, don't. All right. With us now, the Director of Research and Education Exploration, Rich Tellman. Welcome to the program, Rich.
Thank you, Brooks. Hello.
Rich and I made contact a couple of days ago. He had, you know, synergy is really a strange thing, because Richard made contact with me telling me he had this ancient spearhead. And I mean, you're really going to be fascinated when you hear this. And then, within a couple days, my contact, my very trusted, highly high integrity contact, returned from ancient lands with exclusive first-hand photographs of the dig going on in front of the Sphinx. Wow, how pieces come together. Anyway,
it's true. Amazing.
Give us start us off, Rich. Where do we go from here?
Well, I can only tell you what I've found. 4 years ago, I was on my dad's property with my little boy, and we were just kind of playing in the woods, and he was riding up and down my dad's road, and he came running up to me, and he says, "Dad, look what I found." And I'm thinking he's got a walnut or something, you know. And in his hand, he had a metal arrowhead embedded in stone. And I didn't know the weight of, you know, you just don't, I didn't know the weight of what had just, been handed to me, you know. But from there, I felt like I was kidnapped by some type of spirit where I was being telepathically channeled, and I followed eating utensils and chippings for about 2 years, and finally, let's just say it led me to an ancient civilization that's just they were exquisite artists, and they were covered by an ancient sea, and then the glaciers re-exposed what had happened. So I have found an ancient civilization that I believe that glaciers have uncovered in the Midwest of the United States.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the importance of what it means to have an iron spearhead embedded in stone.
Yeah, I believe it's hematite from what I've gathered, from Michael Cremo and Dr. Carl Baugh, who has a metal hammer embedded in stone with a coalified handle. I spoke with him and just from local experts, I believe it's hematite, which is one of the main constituents of iron. And I would be interested in knowing the date, of a relic like this. And what would be the right, the right approach? Would it be an isotope type of testing? To date the metal, I'm imagining it's billions of years old. To see limestone can form in shorter periods of time, but I don't know. I've been told that even something with this type of density even takes millions of years, but that's a whole disputable thing. Time is something that, I don't know. I've been told that coal can form within years, not even 10 years, under the right pressure, is what I've heard. So I don't know. Time is a
I'm not a geologist per se, although I've certainly spent a lot of time in job trailers out on drill sites with geologists. But I don't really know how long it takes sandstone to form. I would imagine because of its soft.
Well, this is actually limestone. I would believe I'm sure there's sand in there, but it is I believe it's an ocean. See, hematite itself is an oceanic element. It's known to be in the oceanic crust. So, I believe it's somehow coming from the Earth's core. Well, they say there's a 500-mile ball of iron spinning in the middle of the Earth, and that could be what's causing our magnetic gravitational pull, gravity.
Yep.
I don't know. It's amazing. So right now it's in the history books, they say that the Spanish brought metal weaponry to the Americas, but the primitive man had been carving this metal, metal that comes from the earth, not necessarily a smeltered thing, but they carved the elements that were there, and I have met. I'm just hoping that this
hematite's pretty hard, isn't it? It's much harder than just regular old iron.
And the
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit there.
Pictures, we've even noticed there's a face in the metal. So with a good zoom, you can get in there and you can actually see a face in this arrowhead, which is a pretty neat little thing.
Now, you say that it's carved.
So since then, okay, what we've found is what all of this has led me to is I found what I believe is it's an...
I don't know. I don't want to what's happening. The phone line's dropping out a little bit. I wanted to ask the question, if the hematite is so hard, what kind of tool would they use to carve it? If it's iron, maybe they had to use they heat it up really hot and then use another iron tool or stone of some kind to beat it into shape, a lot like we do, hammer out a sword that's red hot. But I don't know how you machine or manipulate hematite. Would you have an idea? Nope, I guess we've lost that phone call. The studio will try him back, and we'll get him back on. We'll get a little better connection. That's no problem. If we have any experts and metallurgists out there who know the density of hematite, the Rockwell of hematite, what kind of tools it would take to be able to fashion a rock of it into a spearhead, and if you had the technology to make hematite into a spearhead, what in the world would you be using a spearhead for? Wouldn't you have more modern weaponry than a spearhead? It's sort of like making spearheads out of titanium. If you can manipulate titanium and turn it into a workable metal, surely you have the technology where you don't any longer need a spearhead. So that's kind of my thought, kind of like a carbon fiber horse and buggy. If you have any ideas about that or have any input, it's 415-762-1161, anywhere on planet or off planet. We're getting Rich back as we speak, and we'll talk a little bit more about this mysterious spearhead. By the way, you know, don't think this is too strange that you're just walking along the farm one day and up pops an arrowhead. For instance, in the areas around North Carolina, the Appalachia, eastern Kentucky, middle Tennessee, the Indians, Native Americans, and even races older than that proliferated in the area. And we're not talking about hundreds of spearheads. We're talking about millions of spearheads. Well, you would think, you know, year after year, you'd pick over just about all the land. But what happens in the wintertime when it rains or when it snows is that the earth moves around a little bit. Soil moves kind of psychically, especially in non-clay areas where it's less solid ground. And believe it or not, fields can grow rocks. I've picked the rocks out of my front yard for a couple of years after I built my new house. It seemed to just grow rocks. So you just walk around from time to time, pick up the rocks, and throw it over to the next field. Those of you that have colonial ancestors immigrants in the 1700s or early 1800s, they're very familiar with this. Every spring, you go out and plow, and when you plow, up come the rocks. So it's not uncommon to have something that a glacier dragged along a sediment area, crushed into a piece of limestone, and preserved for posterity to pop its way to the surface where a small boy could find it and pack it back to his father. Now we have evidence of something ancient, something, a piece of technology, a use of technology that is far beyond what current archaeologists are saying is the timeline for modern man. And this is what we're trying to correct here on this program. If we can get the textbooks to agree that times are changing. In fact, we're learning more and more about our past, and what we thought was fact is now back in the realm of theory, and there are other hypotheses which need to be worked out. I believe Rich is back with us. Welcome back, Rich.
Hi, Brooks. Sorry about that.
So I was asking the question, how hard is hematite? I mean, does this have the same Rockwell? Rockwell, by the way, is a measurement of hardness. Does it have the same Rockwell as, say, iron?
Yeah, it's very dense. It has a beautiful tarnish to it. It has a reflective quality. It's a very dense, beautiful metal. I would imagine that whoever created it was probably working it with fire. Density, like it may have been hammered.
Yeah, pounded into shape with another rock. If you had the ability to manipulate iron or hematite in this fashion, why in the world would you make a spearhead? I mean, it's sort of like a titanium spearhead or a carbon fiber or horse and buggy.
Yeah, it's about an inch and a quarter, so I would say it may have been more arrow. It could have been on a spear, but I would imagine that it is actually an arrowhead.
Wow.
So that even changes the whole thing, right?
Because you might have a spear, but you might have 50 arrows.
Yeah. Well, this thing is small, so... but if they were using, that even changes the whole thing. Were they using bows, you know? And how elemental is that?
What would you need to penetrate with an iron arrowhead?
I think archaeology is... whoever's writing the history books, I mean, somehow these alternative scientists who are finding all of these amazing discoveries that are just like earth shaking. The things that are being found right now the history books need to be rewritten, and I believe that people like I don't want to go into names, but there are a group of alternative scientists that are the History Channel's, you know, got them on there all the time, and they're conventional science needs to be readdressed. They've got way too much power. The things that they're teaching us, I believe, are, you know, they have an agenda, and I don't believe it's necessarily to the betterment of the human species. You know, I think there may be a conspiracy going on.
In the world, would they create a history that wasn't true? You know, if the truth is what we're after, if the truth is what we pride ourselves in, and what we receive self-satisfaction of sharing with our students, why in the world would a history teacher open a history book and teach something which he knows, and even worse, his students already know, isn't true?
Right. When all of this occurred, it brought up, it kind of threw me midstream into, like, the evolution versus creation. I didn't want to, when I set out in this, my agenda was not to prove or disprove either of the two. But now that I'm finding things that are, I believe that I could have found the human element over in sediments over a billion years old. So Jonathan Gray said, if any human being was ever found in Carboniferous strata, that it should change the way that history and the world is viewed as far as the antiquity of humanity. Are you there? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm losing you. I've got a bad connection. I believe man could have been here, like, from very, very near the beginning, in volcanic and asteroid-ridden country.
Well,
with the dinosaurs.
Are we making
man and dinosaurs? Assumption? We've got a real bad connection.
Yeah, maybe we want to try this again. Maybe it seems to be going away. But if it doesn't go away, we'll get the producer to make another connection. My question is, are we sure that these were humans using these tools?
Brooks, I'm going to call right back.
All right, that's what we need to do. So that would be my question to you as well, Earth Explorers. I know there are lots of you out there. In the first hour, we covered the dig in front of the Sphinx. And we're going to cover that a little bit more in the next hour. Rich is going to be with us for this hour. We're going to talk about this billion-year-old civilization that he discovered in the Midwest. Now, we're not going to give the exact location because I don't want you jumping in your SUVs and grabbing your shovels and going out there and ruining the whole thing. We'll do this in an organized way, official way, so that the truth comes out and we'll get some civilian oversight and try to see what's going on over there. This is something that changes our perspective. We realize that Earth wasn't made in 6,000 years. And certainly man hasn't only been on the Earth for 6 or 7 or 8,000 years. He's been here a long, long time, and he has reached levels of technology that defy explanation. And that's what we're trying to do here, is we're trying to explain it. We're trying to explore it. And we want you along for the trip, because the exploration is what makes life interesting. So now we have Rich back. Let's see if we have a better connection. Are you there?
Yeah. Hi.
All right.
Anyway, the Flintstones just went through my mind after I lost you there. They should never have put on the Flintstones if they didn't want me to think man and dinosaurs existed together. And then nobody told me they didn't. So I started finding even sculptures that are showing dinosaurs in them, and it's pretty amazing.
Maybe cartoons are the way that they really get the truth out there. So Barney
exactly.
And Crit are really educators. So now you're saying that you have found ancient art or pottery with art on it that have a co-presence of humans and dinosaurs at the same time?
Yeah. Well, what happened is I was rocking my shower stall in my basement because my son and I were moving into my basement and getting ready for this Ozark winter. So I was looking for stones to put in my basement, and on the top of this pile was this piece of sandstone looking up and smiling at me. So from when that happened, I'm getting another call in. Let's just say when I found this that sandstone skull almost part of my shower. But anyway,
I was walking along a road in Egypt one time, and on the side of this walkway was a literal avalanche of little white stones, almost like unbelievable. They just blown it up with dynamite or something and shoveled it over there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge amount, dozens and dozens of tons of these things. Walking along, minding my own business, I look down, and what do I see? A fully petrified clam. So I put it in my pocket and took it home.
That's what I said. Yeah. I said, history is learning that we all live at the bottom of an ancient ocean, you know? I believe that this ancient civilization, that this glacier has most likely uncovered was Lemuria. I would have to say it was Lemuria, and I can only say that is if this oceanic strain of humanity with this bone coming off the back, I was able to find it in the Human Origins Museum in Italy, in multiple areas in their archives. So I was able to find it there. I found it in the desert past Turkey. I found it in the Mayan glyphs, this protrusion from the back of the skull. What I believe this is the original man that existed upon the earth when it was 96% ocean. It's just the oceanic element that I'm finding in all these sculptures that I used to say Atlantis, but that's only if Atlantis had this type of, I want to go back to the Anunnaki almost because, it is human, but then it's a mix. When I say missing, when I think, when I I've been saying it's the missing link of creation because I believe that it shows humans existing in sediments older than any primate fossils ever found.
Sure, I can see that.
I believe, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and the fact that you've dated it about this time makes sense, too, because the Ozarks, the Appalachians, that area is some of the oldest land that we have on this continent. And when you consider that the land areas are all somewhere between 2 and 4 billion years old, that the Earth is actually about 4.5 billion years old. But, you know, it takes a while to cool once you collapse from an accretion disk. So as far as it being able to support life, we had to give the algae a few hundred million years to change
right.
all the carbon dioxide and methane into oxygen.
And
oil and those kinds of things, so that you know, once the algae works on something for a few hundred million years, then you have an atmosphere loaded with oxygen, and now it's ready for carbon dioxide emitting oxygen consuming beings, namely humanoids.
Exactly.
But like you said, if it's pre-billion year old, it's quite possible the Earth was still expanding in those years, because many people don't know it, but the ocean floor, the oldest ocean floor that we have measured, is only 70 million years old. The youngest is around 10 million, and we haven't even measured the Arctic bottom. It's sitting at 4,400 meters, and we just haven't taken samples off the bottom yet. It could be 15 or 20 million years old. Well, that's a baby compared to dry land, the land that we walk upon. So this.
So does that mean that the original? Does that mean that the original?
I was going to say the billion-year-old dry land is the place where people lived, and it had to be
right.
high land. That.
I had this thought that everywhere that man exists today, the dry land used to be seas, and everywhere that is now ocean could very well have one point been dry land. Is that not possible?
Well, yes, at one point. And if you really look at the age difference between the seafloor and the dry land, the seafloor is recently formed, which means the crust expanded like a balloon blowing up and the crust cracking open and filling in with molten material. And then cracking open and filling in with molten material. Some planets don't make it. They fly apart like an asteroid belt, or they spit off a piece of themselves like a giant moon, like Mercury was once part of Venus. But some planets, like Earth, they just crack and fill in, crack and fill in, crack and fill
yeah.
in.
And, so the and then cover over themselves, right? The plates.
Yeah, it just fills in. And then what happens is the sea recedes and goes to the low-lying areas, which is that new seabed. And so you end up with oceans and continents.
Well, I was talking to a friend. We're talking about channeling and the telepathic ability. I was talking to a friend earlier, and I said, and I brought up the fact that I'm finding these faces in lava and like earth-forming like metals. Well, an hour after that, I went into this creek in the city, which is not even on my discovery site, and I found this face in lava with a perfect hole through the eye. It looks like it was something that you would find, you know, it was amazing. You're finding faces in lava. I feel like they were trying to prove that they existed in these elements, you know?
Isn't that wild? When you think about this, Rich, when you think about as you're going over your ancient site there and being very careful to preserve things and report things correctly,
right.
Do you think about their daily lifestyle? How did they get through a day, through a winter?
It looks to me that they were very preoccupied with leaving a legacy. They were trying to say something in the rocks. They were trying to show, I feel like they were trying to show the intention, almost an intention of the human species. The fact that you're having the duplicity of two species in the same effigy. They were showing humans existing with this animal-like, almost space creature. So I believe that, I mean, the fact that I found this astronaut air tube after this, and you want to talk telepathy, I mean, it just feels like there's, I believe that in when the Earth was covered much by ocean, that extra did visit the Earth. I don't want to take a stance, but I'm finding that evidence, you know.
Well, you know, oftentimes we think about anthropology, we think about the development of mankind. Maybe we think about it from an evolutionary point of view, that apes were here and then something happened and genes got spliced and man was formed. But what we're really finding, honestly, is we're finding that man has been around a long, long time. Now, Rich has got evidence that based on the geology in which these artifacts are being found, somewhere around a billion years old, it looks like man was here before the apes.
Are you there?
Yeah, I just asked
I'm getting clicks. People are dialing in. So.
Oh, yeah. They're all, hey, Rich, I hear you on the radio. What's going on?
Yeah, exactly, right? Now I can only hear like two-thirds of the words you're saying, you know. I just hope that this discovery can blossom into a real tool in finding the truth of our origins, and I don't know. I'm seeing the human element among dinosaurs, and I'm what could appear to be extraterrestrial. But you know, I've read things from the 1800s that were saying that humans could exist on other planets, that they're, just because we call them extraterrestrials, that they said that we all belong to one brotherhood, a brotherhood of humanity, you know. So that's called Men on Other Planets, and it was written by Swing. There's a book called Pearls from Many Seas, and in that book there's a passage called Men from Other Planets, and it talks about actually humans are existing on other planets and traveling the solar system. So I don't know.
Well, you know, I would like to say I believe in that. What I would really like to see is somebody open up a cave or open up a cavern in which somebody parked their old ship and couldn't get it off the planet. And here it is some kind of condition where we can look at it. Like I said, the interesting thing to me is that you have found a hematite spearhead that has been... smashed into a limestone rock. Somehow the limestone rock broke open, and there's the spearhead embedded in it.
I believe it was actually formed around it at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah,
I believe
exactly.
That the sea bottom actually solidified around it.
So the point is that they had the technology to work iron, and yet they were still making arrowheads out of it. Like I was saying when we were trying to redial you up, it's a little bit like discovering a carbon fiber buggy that's horse-drawn. If they have the ability to make the carbon fiber, why are you still using horse-drawn equipment? If you have the ability to work advanced metals like that, hard metals, and make artifacts and make tools out of it, you realize iron can go, especially iron that dense, can go through just about anything. You can work any kind of stone, any kind of wood. You know, why would you still be using arrowheads?
My dad even raised the question. Because I'm finding all of these axes, like ocean axes, tomahawks and stuff. And my dad says, "Why would you?" He's a skeptic, and he says, "Why would they form axes out of such soft sediment?" And it's because it's oceanic. And I said, Dad, that's all they had. It was ocean land. They were living on a reef, you know. So I believe that these artists used the elements that they were using, it was dating the elements that were available to them and plentiful on the earth at that time. And I'm just seeing it very, very ancient, like volcanic, in a volcanic situation. Possibly at the time, I'm believing that it could have been when Yellowstone erupted last. I believe they say, I'm guessing that it's somewhere around 600 million years ago. But who knows? It seems like a... May I read you what I was talking about, Swing, Men on Other Planets? It's a quick paragraph.
Yeah, sure. Paragraphs is fine.
Okay. The vastness of the universe renders foolish the supposition that this little planet is the only inhabited one, and the unity of laws and of substances asks us to imagine the beings upon other spheres to be moving to and fro in the likeness of man, speaking a language and busied by the useful and the beautiful. We may even assume that such is the oneness of intelligent life, that if these inhabitants of different planets were to meet in some general home in immortality, they would prove to be of one race, a human race, having different minor details of history, but all members of one brotherhood and capable of one friendship, one virtue, one taste, one piety, 10,000 worlds full of one music, one art, one tenderness, one creature, man, one God. Anyway.
Yeah, incredible. It sounds like it needs to be part of the preamble of the Bill of Rights. When we look at constitutions, creeds, parliaments, kingdoms, governments, we look at the patriotism of that individual nation or that individual tribe or province as opposed to all other nations, as opposed to all other tribes. And that isn't, I believe, the ultimate or the optimum condition of mankind. To have divided ourselves into countless numbers of counties and tribes and townships and different patriotisms, and dividing ourselves in wealth, in education, in benefits to health and clean water, to the ability to travel and obtain knowledge, this isn't the way the civilization of man is supposed to work. What Rich just read is the way the civilization of man is supposed to work. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah,
so what are you feeling when you're out there on your dig, you're out there on your site, I suppose in the Ozarks, you can sort of go out in the wintertime. You don't have really terrible winters like they do up north, but still,
everything
they can be pretty
sticks to the ground.
Yeah, exactly. What do you feel when you're out there alone? Do you hear the voices? Do you hear perhaps the ancient ripple of their intelligence or their consciousness while you're out there?
That's so funny you say that. Sometimes when I feel like I'm on, I mean, I believe all ground is holy ground, but when I'm in the middle of something sacred, and all of a sudden you feel this, like the wind and the trees, and you can, and it is, it's like you can feel the spirits of ancient man, the spirits of the elements that my hands are going through. I don't know if it's the exact same thing, but it's pretty amazing. It's like they sweep up and they say, "That's us," you know.
You're not out there with a front loader and a forklift like this shaft.
I load everything up in the front of my T-shirt. I use it as a cradle. I carry it all in my... We use buckets, but, I mean, usually we're just pockets full of snail faces, you know. That's the beautiful thing that we found is these artists started using these, we call it ammonized facialization. They used these snails to create eyes and mouths in these sculptures, and then they would get in there and carve the teeth and stuff. But like I said, when it's that they were trying to let us know what elements were available to him, I was, it's just got that ocean, it just drips of ocean, you know. It's beautiful. It's just an amazing thing. I want to say, I just, something in my heart just says Atlantis, but I think it's older, you know. It's got that.
Well,
it's got
we have our ideas of where Atlantis and Lemuria were. We think that Atlantis, of course, in the Atlantic, and Lemuria in the southern Pacific, maybe going out as far as Hawaii.
Yeah.
But the ocean between California and Hawaii is pretty deep. It's not like just a bimini deep, you know, 30, 40 meters deep. We're talking about several thousand feet. And, of course, off of the Atlantic, you've got the Mindanao Trench going down 23,000 feet. These are rips in the skin of the earth. So when we're looking for Atlantis, we're looking for Lemuria. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's right under our own feet.
What if it's, yeah, exactly. I feel like I say that I have found a dry land oceanic discovery, you know. It's where there was sea, it's now dry, and you don't have to put on a bunch of scuba gear to find this stuff.
Well, you know, when you take 25E, if you're taking I-75 south and you get to 25E around Corbin, Kentucky, and you turn east and go through the Cumberlands, mountains, and you can get up there, a couple thousand feet, 3,000 feet in some places. Mount LeConte is 6,000 feet. You see all kinds of trilobites and seashells and stuff. And this is not an area that's an overthrust area like out west. This wasn't pushed up out of the sea floor. This always was. This is one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world. Ocean covered it at one time, just like you said.
Right. And the peaks were islands. What wasn't covered, where it had receded, where the water receded after, say, a great flood, then there were little islands, and I believe that primitive man had the ability to travel between those islands.
Sure,
I believe that there was a world catamic.
It would have predated the Great Flood by a long way.
I'm not sure exactly which I don't know how many great floods, I mean, in cataclysmic, you know,
I have somebody.
That's getting into dating again, and time, I don't know if it's been, because don't we only have like 15,000 years or something of written history?
Well, if you don't count the Sumerian texts go back 25,000 years, and a lot of them are clay trading tablets and stories, and some of them, experts like Zachariah Sitchin and others have tried to translate. That's where we got the Anunnaki from in the first place. Rich, I have somebody Skyping in wanting to know the title of the book that you just read from.
Oh, that was called Pearls from Many Seas.
And who's that by?
It's called Men on Other Planets was the name of the piece, and it's in a book called Pearls from Many Seas, and the author who wrote that Men on Other Planets is Swing, SWING.
Okay.
I found that book in an old rare bookstore.
I like those. Whenever I go to small towns, especially in the Midwest, I love to go to news bookstores. You never know what you're going to find in there. These guys collect everything from all of the old libraries, from people that have died in estates. They'll go in and buy all the old books.
Yeah, you can find some amazing wisdom and knowledge in those things.
Stuff
you don't see in mainstream.
I got a book on, it was called Thinking and Destiny. And this was written way back in the late 50s. And I read the book. It's incredibly thick, and you have a desire to lay it down within an hour of picking it up or less and try to digest what you've read, because it's written that deeply. But it's very modern in its thinking, really made for the age of technology, which, of course, there was none of that in the 50s and early 60s. I was really, really taken aback of the foresight and terminology and references that he had in there that were quite forward thinking.
Yeah, it's almost like truth has a ring to it, and it's when you hear it and you know it, and it sounds right now, you know. No matter how old it is, if it's true, it has a ring to it, you know, a familiar ring. And so I understand what you're saying.
Well, speaking of a familiar ring, when you're out there communing with your source of knowledge, which your son has introduced you to, do you ever wonder about how the civilizations lasted? Where did they go? Did they just blend into our DNA, or did they pack up everything and leave the planet, or did they go extinct and we started over? Or do you get any kind of feeling like that?
What does definitely ring in my ears is why and what is leading me to these things. Is there a higher power that wants a message to be told here, and he is channeling through me, or that source? The fact that it has this missing link of humanity, the true origin, and I believe that. I don't know. It makes you think and wonder, were angels, you know, were angels just extraterrestrial or celestial beings? Well,
they couldn't be. They could be one and the same. It just depends on an interpretation. The fact that a being can go through a veil and travel across a time that we don't understand into another dimension, a dimension where maybe they could see the future pretty clearly, or maybe they could see multiple futures if we do this or don't do that, if we don't behave, if we don't change our ways. Maybe there are alternative futures that they can see.
Feel like something is telling me, just like you just said, something is trying to channel through me that is trying to convey a message that is saying that we need to change our ways, definitely. Definitely, I believe that is the underlying tone here, is that we have the ability to change our ways and save ourselves from creating our own, the end of our, you know, of humanity.
Well, we have a finite amount of energy on this earth. That being said, we do have a source of energy 93 million miles away that we're learning a little bit more about every year. And we were talking about the SDO, the Solar Dynamics Observatory, in the first part of the program tonight. But that being said, we have basically a finite set of energy. And although we have a tendency to look at things as though, well, it's only one generation. Who cares if we use it all up? I'm not going to be around to enjoy it or to suffer through the loss or the darkness or the nuclear winter or fill in the blank. But there are a vast majority of us who are somewhat silent, or we're inspired. And I get the feeling that you're inspired, who feel as though there is a way to live within the limits of the planet and still have a really, really abundant life.
Exactly. Yeah, it saddens me, you know, with all the fossil fuel thing, you know. I look at these horses in the Midwest here, and you see these beautiful animals that are just standing still up against trees, and I feel like it was the beauty of the horse, and that whole time has been, in the last 100 years, this animal has just, like, taken a, he was taking, we don't use the horse as transportation or for anything anymore, and it's just like a species of beauty is just being swept aside, you know.
I exactly what you're saying. For thousands of years,
I feel like technology, the same thing that modern science is and technology, they've kind of got us into the position we are now. So I don't know. I don't want to sound bitter.
Well, I'm not bitter either. But I do. You know, we get to a point where we have enough technology that we don't have to spend a majority of our day tilling the ground, planting seeds, harvesting, grinding, you know, aging, you know, sewing our own clothes, making our own yarn, you know, growing wool and all that on sheep and shearing.
You know,
There's a beauty in it, though.
I have some favorite little dinosaur bowls. These primitive men have carved these bowls out of petrified dinosaur. And my neighbors were worked at a coffee shop, and they would bring me these fresh beans, and I would get my pistle, turn it into a mortar and pestle, and I would grind. I would call it fresh dino grind. And there's a beauty when you're dealing with those elements. It does bring you closer to the earth, and there is a beauty in doing things. There's a harmonious element there in nature, you know.
Yeah, there is something to be said about taking the time to do things. And we had Leonid Sharashkin on the program earlier in the year, and he was talking about the book Anastasia, and in the book, it describes a method of taking the seeds that you're going to plant of plants and throwing them in your mouth for about 5 or 10 minutes and let them soak up the saliva from your mouth. And then you plant them. And when the seed grows into the total plant, it uses the DNA memory that it got from you to provide the nutrients that your being needs. Locally grown squash, locally grown peas and carrots and potatoes and things like that. Well, I thought to myself, wow, that really makes, you know, scientific sense to me. Look at us now. We ship in our food from Mexico and California and wherever it's, you know, bananas and cabbage and artichokes and whatnot, kiwis. But they're not grown here. They're not grown out of the soil that makes up our body. We're being made up of soil from all over the planet. And look at us. We're full of allergies and weaknesses and failing organs and eyesights and flawed DNA. Maybe they had the right idea. So when I think about these ancient civilizations and the fact that they had to be advanced enough to get here. They had to be smart enough to outsmart nature. And yet they chose to live within nature. Don't you find that fascinating? All right, I think we dropped the call again. My producer's right on top of it, I know. But that's a good question to ask you, Earth Explorers. The phone number here is 415-762-1161. Have we got too smart for our britches? Are we living in a technological age between our iPod and our fuel-injected car that we have forgotten about our link with the very planet upon which we live? My question to you, Rich, is these people were advanced enough to be able to work iron. They were artistic and took their time and lived life within harmony with nature. Do you think this was the highest echelon of living, or do you think we have yet to achieve it?
I think it would be something a beautiful system to return to. there is a true beauty in the things that we can find in nature. Yeah, like what you just said about the iPods and the electronic games that are my son's addicted to, Xbox and the whole thing. I believe that the further I got away from the lures of society, I was stuck out in the country for a couple years without transportation, and I got closer to the earth, and I felt the further I got away from the media and the lures of society and really took time to see where I was and not to mention the fact that I had been sort of taught to look down all my life, you know, by a suppressed society in a way. I also joke that's why I'm so good at doing flooring and tile and stuff is because I've been taught to look down. It's just, I feel like there's a real... I hope that the message in our discovery shows that man is worthy of better things than self-destruction, you know.
Well,
I
want
to
believe that,
too. We need to turn to nature, for sure.
I think that if we listen to the press all the time, we have a recycling of death and fear and on the precipice of misunderstanding, we lose perspective of who we are, what the value of humanity is, why we are here, and what message the ancients tried to leave in stone and metal and codexes and legends so that we'd have some idea of how to do it right. We lose sight of that. We get locked up in this cycle, this Xbox, PlayStation 3 mentality. And maybe we're ever learning and never coming to a knowledge of the truth. However, I have a feeling that the human race is on the verge of evolution. It really is. Even though a majority of the planet still has to walk for a day to get to a telephone, we are on the verge of evolution. Human consciousness is about to make a giant leap, not a quantum leap, a giant leap forward as a single being, as a race. And it's going to make an echo in the universe. It's going to make a reverberation. Make no mistake about that.
Well, I got distracted earlier when I was trying to say that I was thinking of a stance between evolution and creation, and I thought this, you know, I thought everything that it was created evolves, and everything that evolves was created. There's got to be a neutral stance where you're not fighting each other, you know. Everything evolves. So, but that doesn't mean that I don't know. I believe that finding man in let's say 600 million year old sediment just at least says that man existed then. I don't know if that means that he did or did not come from primates. I feel that the whole, I don't want to come across with a slanted view, but I really do believe that science and government are, if they can prove that we came from primates, that they can deny us our God-given rights. And I don't want to sound negative, but I feel if they can prove that we come from a lower species, then they can treat us as if we are lower. And I don't know.
They came from the same species. And the idea that, you know, our legacy is a primate with the IQ, you know, of an infant, with instincts, of course, but still not enough intellect to protect itself from nature with anything other than brute strength. And a herd mentality, we know better than that, because there, besides the fact that we have a frontal cortex with which we can figure out complex problems, we have something animals do not. We have desire. We have will.
Yeah.
We have the ability to pull ourselves up from our own bootstraps and overcome. We also have the ability to change, which animals do not. We learn, we grow, we become merciful, we become benefactors, or we become wicked. Animals don't do that. There's an animated being inside of us that drives us past our humanity.
Wow. Beautifully said. Very well said.
Well, listen, Rich, I'm overjoyed that you came on the program, especially on short notice. You've been a wonderful, wonderful guest. Again, you're
Thank
the director
you.
Of research.
I get excited. I apologize.
Oh, it's not a problem. Director of research and exploration for what organization?
Fossil Fields Discoveries. We have 6 YouTube movies posted, and we can be reached. May I say the Fossil Fields email?
Or? Sure. Give us all your contact
information. We are at thefossilfields@aol.com, and we have we can also be reached on Facebook and MySpace. We also have an online store at www.zazzle.com/thefossilfields. We're just trying to help fund our discovery. So, anyway, God, what a blessing. I hope we can talk again.
Is that Zazzle? Zazzle?
Yeah.
Slash?
Yeah, that's www.zazzle.com/thefossilfields.
Okay, great. We will definitely put the link on the website. Have a wonderful week, my friend.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking to you again very soon, sir.
All right. Thank you and good night.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, we will take a quick 7-minute break. Maybe not the whole thing, but let you get a drink. Let me change tapes, and we'll move on with the rest of our program. We have so appreciated you being with us here tonight. I'm Brooks Agnew, and this is X Squared Radio. As we enter the third hour here of X Squared Radio, we're listening to a little of Killia off the Nine Worlds album, if you want to know who it is. We are going to consider some more, another ancient site in Egypt that is undergoing some, might be authorized digs, but you need to know the real history behind it. Deep into Egypt is an area past the Nag Hammadi. Those of you familiar with the Nag Hammadi texts, this is where they came from. The caves and the cliffs around Nag Hammadi are where different bands of marauders used to come through, and shepherds would drive their sheep into caves there to keep them safe as they passed, and then come back out of the caves and be able to negotiate an area it was somewhat lawless, and the defenseless managed to stay alive in this manner. And so when it came time to hide records, one of the places that was the favorite were the caves. And sure enough, in the caves of the Nag Hammadi, some clay pots filled with sand and then buried in the sand, copper scrolls, words written on copper, once malleable and easy to manipulate, then oxidized and hard and difficult to handle, buried in clay jars. Not discovered by archaeologists, but discovered again by a shepherd. Instead of turning them into the authorities, however, poverty being what it is, and men's desire to do just a little bit better, the combination of which resulted in these scrolls being sold on the black market, probably for about 20 years. And then the scrolls got into the right hands, not all of them, but a few of them. And then over time, as their value increased, the rest of them, most of them, were rounded up. The challenge was how to unroll the scrolls. They were no longer malleable, but now more the consistency of clay, unfired clay. And so they finally figured out that if they took the plates and sawed them in half with a bandsaw lengthwise, then they could take all of the pieces and put them back together, sort of like a wavy scroll, and they would have the hieroglyphs and writings to put together. Well, that's what happened. Many resources, including those from BYU, from other areas around the world, experts came together, and slowly but surely, the texts were translated. You could now buy them in English, even, in Nag Hammadi text. Now, they're still fragmented, not complete sentences. Some of the statements are disjointed, but there's evidence of other leaders, of other noted people of power and knowledge in the days of Jesus and even before. And this is the legacy of this land. Not far from Nag Hammadi, about an hour's bus ride. And if you go to Egypt, it's not very easy to negotiate the country. You don't just rent a car in Cairo and take off. American tourists especially are not welcome in by themselves in some of the outlying areas. You have to have special connections. You have to build a personality. You have to know people and build relationships. That's why it's so difficult to get into these areas, get the kind of exposure, the kind of access that it takes to gain this rare knowledge. Not with a tour group, or if it is with a tour group, a very special tour group. But you have to go at the right time. You've got to be in the right conditions, in the right mindset, the right setting, the right attitude, the right intention. That's how difficult it is to get into these areas and find the truth. Not far from Nag Hammadi, about an hour's bus ride, is a temple known as Abydos. Abydos is well known for those that have toured the area. It's a site that is still under restoration. There's scaffolding on the inside of the building where, being defaced by conquerors of old who, thinking that the writings on the walls, as glorious as they were, the carvings of hieroglyphs and scenes and people and relationships on the ceilings and the walls, was of some primal, primitive mindset. And those conquerors, of course, being much more intelligent, much more wise, much more schooled in the wisdoms of the world, thought it would be nice to stack cattle in them, douse them with oil, and light them on fire. And the soot from this debauchery still coats the walls and the ceilings of these buildings. Slowly, painstakingly, experts, workers, are dabbing and washing this old residue off of these wonderfully ornate, beautiful, colored carvings on the walls and ceilings of Abydos. As amazing as that is, as amazing as the story of Isis and Osiris told on the walls of Abydos, there's a legend of a hall of records at the Temple of Abydos. They've been searching for it ever since it was shoveled out of the sand. Dorothy Seti, also known as Om Seti, Dorothy Eddy, also known as Om Seti, a British woman, woke up over a period of her life and knew that she was the reincarnated female priestess of the Temple of Seti and that she had a relationship with Seti. She was an old woman when she made her way to Abydos. Abydos was being excavated, being dug out painstakingly as a government project under the leadership of a man named Haniel Zaney, who was extremely intelligent, hardworking engineer that ran a sugar plant. And when Dorothy Seti showed up, or Dorothy Eddy showed up, Om Seti, she was called, she told her story of how, who she felt she was. And as the story goes in her book, or in the book that was published about her, she went out into the desert not far from Abydos where they were digging and said, I used to live here in a village. Well, there was no village there, but sure enough, they dug down and there it was. Over the years, they began to respect her. They deferred to her on several things about the temple as they uncovered one thing and another. And she remembers a hall of records, a secret treasure room. It's never been found. But there's something even more amazing about the temple. Because if you go behind the temple, even more ancient, and I mean more ancient, going back about 10,000 years, was another edifice called the Osirian. And the Osirian still defies definition. When I look at it, it looks to me like an ancient power generation station. Large amounts of ionic power can be generated by the water flow, the aquifer that is there, the red granite that's used to build it, and the ability to store and generate power. Now, it wouldn't be much voltage, but it would be a whole lot of amperage. The interesting thing is the way that it's built, it's not built with anything on top of it. It's just open. It hooks up to something. That something isn't there. When Seti's engineers were looking for a place to build his temple, they discovered, as the story goes, the Osirian. As the temple was built, they ended up building it in the shape of an L. It wasn't built as a square. It wasn't built as like any other temple in all of Egypt. It was built to defer to the Osirian. Now, it seems, there's excavation going on at the Osirian. Secret digs, some with bulldozers, some just drilling holes so that they can run side-scan sonar, side-scan ground-probing radar into the area to look for secrets underneath the Osirian. Something is going on. An invasion into the ancient secrets below the desert floor. When I was in Egypt, we went out to an area that's it's difficult to get to. It's, believe me, not on the average tour route. To get there, you have to hire a cab. You have to go outside of Cairo, on the very outskirts of it. You have to walk through a date grove and go around a fence and walk out into the desert quite a ways. But as you walk out there, you top the hill and come down on an area known as Abu Ghraib, City of Ghraib. So while we're there, and this area looks like a battle zone, a small pyramid, what appears to be the largest single alabaster slab known in the world, machined in a very, very curious manner, in a shape aligned perfectly with north, south, east, and west. I put a compass on it and checked it myself. It appears that machine or some kind of metal apparatus was fixed into this alabaster slab and was used for some purpose. Around the alabaster slab are about 1.5 meter blocks of alabaster in which are carved bowls about, almost a meter in diameter. And about 80 centimeters deep, something like that. And the bowls are very smooth on the inside, but that's not the most amazing part. The amazing part is the rim of the bowl, around the rim of the bowl, machined into the alabaster, is a sprocket like a gear. Teeth of a gear, a giant gear, in the lip of the bowl. And in the tooth of the sprocket, each one, a small hole is bored, about the size of your thumb. This is not a decoration. This is functional. In the sides of the bowl are bored what look like about 50 millimeter holes. Now, it could be said, and it has been said by some British archaeologists, that these were used for ritual washings and anointings and things like that, and that the hole in the side was just a place for the water to drain out if the bowl overflowed. But when you look at these from an engineering standpoint, that's not what they look like at all. And why would you use alabaster fixed over a mica base? Because the two elements together amplify magnetic fields. They amplify and create electrical fields. Mica is used in making circuit boards, printed circuits. Alabaster is a known dielectric. So in the sides of the bowls, suppose for a moment that you would put a gold rod and that you would affix a battery to the gold rod, and that you would sprinkle ionic gold into the water, or whatever fluid you were using there. And suppose, affixed to the sprocket around the rim of the bowl, you fixed some mechanism that stirred the water, or that moved items through the water. You now have the ability to electroplate. Now you have the ability to make very, very thin, almost transparent layers of gold on things. This is technology. And when you look at this, you can clearly see that this temple, this pyramid, has been blown apart by some kind of power. No, there's no evidence of missiles, there's no evidence of looting, there's no evidence of dynamite, there's no carbon embedded in the sides of the granite stones. It is blown apart. However, there is evidence of high heat being applied to the stone. Half of the stones out, 50, 60 meters from that temple, are blue on one side and regular colored on the other side, where clearly they have been half exposed to very intense heat. You can find pottery shards for 100 yards in every direction around this. No, I didn't pack any of them home, but I have photographs of them. Here's the interesting thing, and this is why I bring this up right now. While I'm standing on top of this blown apart pyramid with my cameras in hand, snapping photographs and shooting film, it's 55 degrees. There's not a tourist as far as the eye can see. Far out in what would be known as the edge of the city of Heliopolis, if it still existed, far out in the desert, perhaps a quarter of a mile away, out beyond the edge of Cairo, where no roads exist, came three giant front loaders. Big caterpillar equipment that came out of that area of the desert. These are the big ones. These are the ones with the 9-yard buckets on them. The ones that split in the middle, you know, like a giant dinosaur. You ride it in a cab with a steering wheel, and when you turn it, it's hydraulic. It doesn't turn the wheels. The actual machine itself bends in the middle using a hinge and hydraulic rams. These are big earth-moving pieces of equipment. Driving out of the desert, heading into Cairo. As I'm filming them come out of the deep desert, you can hear me say on the film, "Hello, what are you doing out there?" Indeed, because far away, actually it's a long bus ride away, out of the city is Nag Hammadi, and past that is Abydos, and next to Abydos is the Osirian. The Osirian is so old and so mysterious, nobody really knows who built it. But I'll tell you how fantastic it is. It's so fantastic that these granite blocks are perhaps 50 tons, some of them 100 tons, lifted into place and settled in like a key and a lock. And there is no evidence of heavy equipment being used. Indeed, they are lifted perhaps 16 feet up, settled into place. They have metal tie bars tying them together, and the sides of this red granite are as smooth as a tombstone. By the way, the red granite came from 150 miles away in Aswan, not from that region. It's true, the Osirian predates Seti's temple by a long, long way. Seti felt it was necessary to build his temple around this facility. No one knows what role the two played together. But one thing's for sure, there are now digs going on around the Osirian. Secrets are being sought. And we, the world, we are not being involved in that. We are not being made privy to the secrets, the technology, the artifacts, the reasoning, the lifestyle, the wisdom, the source of who built this amazing edifice. So I have a very trusted source, and this person takes risks and has built relationships for many years in this area. And it'll take time, but sooner or later, the truth will come out. And I trust, I hope, that we will be here and we'll be able to participate in that as we have in the last 24 hours. In less than 24 hours, photographs of the daytime digging of the shaft in front of the Sphinx has been taking place, and those photographs have been made immediately available to you without any editing, only with respect to protect the identity of the photographer and to meet the wishes of this person so that they can continue with their relationships of trust, bringing us the truth. And we will endeavor to respect that relationship. We will endeavor to bring the truth of it to you, because of all the Earth's mysteries, this one ranks in the top 10. To know who built the pyramids, to know what was built, why it was built, why so much energy, why such careful project management, and even again, what events blew this stuff apart with incredible amounts of energy? The pictures of these rocks, I don't know what it takes to turn granite, red granite, blue, but it takes a lot of heat. And out at Abu Ghraib, you have to look for it. It's not easy to find. You're not going to find your tour guide's not going to send you to Avagarab. It's difficult to get to, but you get out there. I will perhaps post some other photographs showing you what looks like very intense heat, several thousand degree heat applied to these rocks in a very sudden manner, because it takes a lot of energy to blow red granite apart this way, in this manner. So if you want to be part of the program, our phone number is 415-762-1161. Ramon on line one, welcome to X Squared Radio.
How you doing, Dr. Agnes?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. First of all, I just want to say Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. Whether you are one now or you will be one in the future, Happy Mother's Day. And actually, I was going to ask you, have you attempted or asked anybody to remote view the area, see what maybe they're looking for?
Oh, you know, I really haven't. I think there is some stuff written about that. We were talking to the RV Kronos guy, Ruiz, and I might do that. I might put a call into him and see what he's found of the same thing. I mean, there's got to be something. Edgar Cayce predicted that there was a Hall of Records below the right paw of the Sphinx, and lo and behold, here they are down four or five stories into the ground, right where he said to look. I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I was actually, the other thing I was going to do was, because I had like a small epiphany, and I was wondering if I was able to change the subject a bit.
Sure.
You sound a little skeptical.
No. Okay. Yeah, you're part of the program too. We'll talk about anything you want to talk about.
Well, this is the third hour, so I think this is the perfect time. I want to go past our own imagination. Basically, I was sitting down and I was meditating and I was contemplating something, and I was thinking to myself, you know, if we as souls or physical being, however we're moving into this, moving into the fifth and sixth and seventh dimension, what does it feel like to be in that state of mind? What kind of awareness do we have? What is it that makes us different? Because I know what it's like to be 3D, and I know what it's like to be 2D and 1D, but what is it like to be 4, 5, 6, 7, and above? And I got this idea.
You have to understand, maybe, you know, of course, I look at this from a physicist's point of view. What do those dimensions look like? In some cases, they are rotational dimensions. In other cases, they are dimensions of perspective, like time or, you know, for instance, being able to visually see multiple sides at the same time. That's a little hard for us to understand.
Yeah, well, it's like asking a two-dimensional being to explain what 3D is like. They have no clue. But during that contemplation, I had an idea where, okay, so the universe is believed that it was created through the Big Bang, which really is not an explosion. It's more a balloon expanding, and that's what our universe is. So we got that part down. And the idea I had was, once the universe gets to a certain point, instead of it, I would say disintegrating is the wrong word, but breaks apart into a bunch of little pieces that then form other universes. And that's how one universe gives birth to billions or trillions of other universes. And
I can see that. You know, there's another idea, and that is that the physical universe, the universe of the dimension that we see, that we feel and touch and live in, is actually just a creation of the intention of human beings.
That's what I'm getting to. The idea is, like, for example, we reach certain dimensions and we grow, and I'm speaking like billions of years from now, our spirits, it gets to a point when the universe is ready to expand that way, that we ourselves become a new universe. So our soul itself becomes the universe, let's say, B. And, you know, Dr. Agnew's soul becomes universe C. And we're speaking, you know, billions. So now you're the one who becomes this source or this cosmic consciousness for the entire universe. And then you yourself break apart to create these other souls, whether it be like, because I believe everything has a living consciousness to it, whether it recognizes it or not, like our planet, our stars. And you give consciousness to all these things that you're creating.
Yeah, so I can see that. You know, when we think about
the idea I was having.
We think about the consciousness that many religions and other traditions call God. Some call it Source. Some call it, you know, the great I am, the great realization, self-realization, and the fact that I am, or Source, or God, divided itself or multiplied itself or took the square root of itself, it's difficult to tell, to create, or at least make place for, other aspects of itself or herself or himself, and those intelligences then embody bodies of flesh and blood that experience the universe for Source, and that's the purpose of the creation. Now, that's a mighty large concept, but it kind of goes along with what you're saying.
Yeah, no, and it goes in concept with what, let me see if I get his name correct, Donald Walsh, is that his name? Gentleman who wrote Conversations with God.
Oh, I don't know.
Donald Walsh, he wrote, to give a quick brief about him, he was homeless for a while, and then he heard this voice that said, "Did you have enough?" And he's like, "Oh, God, I'm going crazy." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm God, but you're not crazy." And he wrote these three books, and in one of them he talks about how he's not the God he's talking to is not the top God, that even though he is that same top God, that he's also lower and he's also higher, and that he, well, for lack of a better word, the Source is always trying to grow and expand its awareness, and the way it does is through all these different sentient beings and experiences, and how it itself divides. So it goes into the same thing that we were talking about. If you guys
maybe we shouldn't sweat it so much if we can't make our bills at the end of the month or the beginning of the month. Maybe we shouldn't, you know, care so much that we drive a 15-year-old vehicle and we really want a new one, or we want a big fancy house. Maybe that shouldn't matter to us if it's the experience of the intelligence of the being inside of us that's really the goal of life.
Yeah. And for me personally, for everybody is different, but for me personally, I believe that is the secret of life. That is the reason why being here. It's the constant expansion of your own awareness. And when you're not aware of something and someone explains something to you, you have no idea what they're talking about. You're, oh, he's full of crap, or he's crazy, or whatever. But, and then, you know, years later, you turn around and you're like, that's what he was talking about. And I'm sure we all have experience.
Well,
hello?
I think that the perspective is important. I think that we get sometimes too caught up in the stress of what's going on. Now, it's different if you're trying to do something great. If you're trying to build a company and you're frustrated because you can't raise the money, or you have an idea for some energy producing or saving device, and you can't seem to put the resources together to offer it to the world, that's different. I mean, that's a frustration that burns a hole in your belly and gives you the drive to get up early and go to bed late until you see it come to fruition. These are the kinds of things that change human life, and I think in many respects adds quality to life here on the earth.
Yeah, I agree. And as far as speaking of not worrying about things, I've noticed, I'll tell you a quick story about not worrying about things. Maybe like 10 years ago, I had gotten laid off, and I got laid off right after I came back from vacation. So, of course, I had nothing.
Oh, I hate that.
Oh, man. It was a great lesson learned, but back then I didn't look at it as a lesson.
No, exactly.
Anyway, I'm sitting at my windowsill, and I'm smoking a cigarette, and I'm just so stressed out. And this bird, I think it was a chickadee, just flies to the window. And I know for many cultures, at least in the heritage I was growing up, which is Dominican, we always believe that when a bird comes like that, he's bringing you good news. And I just said to the bird, I hope you got some good news because I'm really stressed out right now. And the bird chirped a little bit at me, and I just looked at it, and it flew away. And I go downstairs, and the checks for the unemployment had come in a couple months altogether. And I was like, wow. So from then on, it was an epiphany not to ever worry. Like, I was recently worried about not making enough money to, because I'm moving to Japan in a couple months.
Really?
With my wife. Yeah. Yeah, so soon I'll be Ramon from Tokyo instead of Ramon from New York.
That's great.
And I was telling my wife, I'm not going to worry about it because the only thing it's going to do is cause us to fight, and it's not going to create more money. And all of a sudden, work just started coming in. Work started coming in. And speaking of that, I was thinking, like, why is it that when a man or a woman is involved with somebody, all of a sudden, all the people that they would have loved to date are hitting on them? And the reason for that is because the law of abundance, the law of attraction. Now, how could you take that idea, which has happened to all of us, and put it into economical or other senses of your life? You know, because you're not, when you're in a situation where you found yourself with someone that you're satisfied with, you're not bothering to look for anything. You're happy with what you have.
Right.
All of a sudden, these other people sense this, and they start hitting on you. Well, how could we do this with money? You know, you're not thinking about abundance. You're not, you know, you have it, so there's no problem. So how could we do this with other, even with our spiritual self? How can we get more awareness without really searching for it? Because when you find a true relationship, you're not searching for it. It's there. There's nothing to search for.
Yeah, I'm totally with you there. I'm totally with you. I don't know. That's a good question. I know that the law of attraction, like attracts like. I also know that when you send your intention, you thump the universe with something. Everything that's going to resonate with that idea rings. But you got to be around to hear the ring. You got to be listening. You know, because that's how the bounty comes to you. It comes to you as a resonance of what the universe has that matches your intention. But it doesn't necessarily, in fact, it almost never comes in the way you think it's going to come.
Okay.
So if you are forcing the universe through a little tiny hole and it doesn't want to go, I'm sorry, but the abundance is not coming your way. You just got to stand on the other side of the wall and wait, because it'll make it through, over, around, or actually any way it can. It'll just materialize through that wall in a way that the universe has in mind, but maybe you don't expect. But you got to listen. Got to be ready.
There's a gentleman that I believe you're either familiar with or you've met before. David Sirita. He did recently, you need to interview him again about this documentary he recently did. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. No, I heard a click. He did a documentary where he's talking about the millivolts of people, and he measured, like, I think it was 100 and something people, And people who suffer from depression or MS had, don't quote me on the numbers, but had something like 30 to 100 millivolts. And the average human being had something like, I think it was 50 to 120 millivolts. And when he did it on Qigong masters and healers, they had 250 and up, and some of them even hit volts. And he was just shocked how these people were hitting these high voltages. So from that, I got the idea. I said, okay, I'm going to make some copper gloves. I just took like a low-gauge wire and just made a small glove. And I meditated with this because if we're like antennas, and that's proven anytime you turn on the radio and the radio is not really doesn't sound good, and you put your hand on the antenna, all of a sudden it works perfectly. So that means you're an antenna yourself. So I put these gloves on,
yeah.
And I started meditating. And nothing spectacular happened, but what was spectacular about it is that I felt a stronger energy that it took me maybe 45 minutes to get to. It took me 10 to 15 minutes.
Huh.
So it's something like if you have time, you should try it out there. And, of course, do not try this outside when there's a lightning strike hitting.
Yeah, you might attract more electricity than you're ready for.
Can handle, yeah. Even though I've heard of some masters getting hit, Max Christian, the gentleman who brought Kunlun into America, supposedly he was hit by lightning and seared open his chakra, his crown chakra.
Wow.
Yeah. So one last question, and I'll get offline because I'm sure a lot of the people want to call. As far as like the crown chakra, do you yourself or experience or know of anybody that the bone up there, maybe the density or the structure or the makeup of it changes on people who have opened it and more in tune with the universe? Maybe like going, for example, I'll give you an analogy, going from the old rabbit ears to the digital antennas that we now have, example. So now you have a more clearer, better connection with the universe or the cosmic internet.
Well, the idea of the crown chakra, from my understanding, especially the physiology of it, is that it lines up with either the pineal gland itself or the focal point of the pineal gland. Now, the pineal gland has an optical quality to it. That is to say, it's made of the same stuff as our eyes. And it has traditionally been understood that the pineal gland was the place where DMT, which is a naturally occurring substance in the body, of course you can make it artificially and really have a hallucinatory trip, but this is the place where imagination, where visions, where inspirations, telepathy, these kinds of precognitive abilities come from. And like the interesting thing about Abu Ghraib and areas around there, they're loaded with calcite. And calcite is the compound it's in the pineal gland. And when we're in close proximity to calcite deposits, we're more open to receiving knowledge and downloads and things like that that we would not normally be exposed to. And, you know, maybe this is why women priestesses were at these sites. The sites were roofed and they were dark. So melatonin is produced in darkness. It makes you, or it actually deprives your body of the crutch of your eyes and makes you rely on the pineal gland for sight. And thus it seems to open up this precognitive ability. Now, naturally, everybody couldn't do it, but there were some who expressed great talent in it and probably were were selected, harvested, trained, and facilitated by society so that they could have this knowledge as part of their toolbox for their community. So when we talk about the crown chakra, this is what we're talking about, this connection to higher realms or higher selves.
So from what you're saying, from my understanding of what you're saying is, because I myself plan to go on a dark retreat when I go to Washington after the conference. But if the room is full of calcite, then that would amplify the visions or the connection that you have. So, for example, if I say, okay, Dr. Agnes, you're really good at this. And I say, Dr. Agnes, I need to know how to build this. For example, how can we get power to generate, you know, whatever we may need? And then you go in there and you sit in that room and deprive your eyes and clear your mind and all this. And you come back, well, this is how you do it. This is how you make it. This is the information I got. So these people would literally be, a computer, where they would connect themselves to the cosmic internet and come back and give the pharaoh information. That's the only thing I pictured when you were saying this.
Huh. Well,
because
interesting stuff.
How else, other than aliens coming down, which is another possibility, and giving the information, or you yourself just connecting yourself? Because every idea is out there in the universe somewhere.
Well, it could be. I mean, if we think of it the way we think of it, time goes from point A to point B in a linear fashion, or at least in an arrow from past to the future, then one has to think, okay, there's an Akashic record out there, but these are things that haven't happened yet, so how are we accessing it? But if you think of it from a physics point of view, there can't be an infinite number of futures because there isn't an infinite number of energy in the universe. The amount of energy, the amount of information in the universe is finite. Therefore, it has to be a somewhat programmed or, shall we say, limited in some fashion reality. You can't have infinite resolution. You can't just keep dividing things smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. They go down to a Planck distance and that's it. So that being the case, maybe all futures, all possibilities already exist in the universe, and it is the human consciousness, the spirit, that taps into those things. Although if we continue to do it in the flesh, where's the challenge? Where's the surprise?
Well, what I would say, the challenge and the surprise is, we all go through this as teenagers where you feel trapped. You feel, I don't want to be like everybody else. And teenagers express this the most. You know, they color their hair, or in the 60s, you know, they grew afros or grew a beard. And there's always this part, at least for myself, speaking for myself, that feels trapped in this body, like,
oh,
you know,
sure.
We're looking for freedom, and we're not even sure what the word itself really means, to be really, really free. I mean, freedom, does that mean that I can buy anything I want now, or does that mean that I can sit here and explore the entire universe, or something even more that I can't even be aware of at the moment?
Well, that's true, but maybe the goal, or not the goal, but maybe the purpose of the design of life is to be limited in this biological transducer we call the human body. It's to have a limited perspective so that we have to stretch. We do it for the experience. We do it for the physical sensations. We love the taste of food. We like to make love. We like to dance. We like to listen to music. We watch movies over and over and over again, and we know what's going to happen, but there's some security in that. But for life, there's no over and over and over. It's different every single time. We get a fresh perspective, and maybe maybe for the sheer entertainment value alone, that's why life is important. But we experience loss and disappointment and love and creation. We experience these wonderful things in human form, and that is so valuable. Look who has come here just to experience that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Agnes, and I'll keep listening off on the radio. It's always a pleasure.
We appreciate you. Don't drop us from your internet dial just because you moved to Japan.
No. It's the only thing, it's going to be harder on time-wise. That means
yeah,
that
it is. It's a 13-hour time difference.
Yeah.
It's okay.
But if you're ever out there, look me up.
Oh, I'll be out there again. I go to Japan every now and then. I really appreciate you, Ramon. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Earth Explorers, I wanted to, in the close of tonight's program, thank you for coming on and listening to us. If you have not experienced the YouTube of this very, very important information that was made available to us early this morning, it's been less than 24 hours since we posted it. I don't know how many thousands of people have watched it. I want you to grab that YouTube, and I want you to post it on your Facebook profiles. Let's get this thing out there. I don't know how long they're going to let me run it. I'll run it as long as I can, and I will continue to bring you the information as freshly as we get it. As I said, I can tell you that that this source is of utmost integrity. And the only reason that this source chooses to remain anonymous at this time is to protect the access, so that as we go forward here in the coming weeks and coming months, and from the Osirian and from Cairo and from other areas around Egypt where these halls of records, these ancient areas are being excavated, heavy equipment, light equipment, and by hand, that we can gain access to it. We can continue to bring you this kind of truth. That's why people come to X Squared Radio. And anytime you want to be part of the program, the number is 415-762-1161. Put it on your fridge. And next week, when we have X Squared Radio Live, call in with your perspective. Or if you want to write it in on Skype, we'll take it that way. We get Skype messages all night long. During the program, just look for X2-Radio, X2-Radio. Always go to xsquaredradio.com. We'll try to have the latest information on there for you. And don't forget, we have a short version, a 30-minute version out right now on webtalkradio.net. Click on that banner at X Squared Radio. That's a really quick program. Usually there are half-hour compressions of what we do here. This is the effort to syndicate X Squared Radio so that we can give late night radio a run for its money. Somehow the truth has to get out there, and we want you involved. We appreciate you coming here on X Squared Radio. My name is Brooks Agnew. We're here every week from 5 to 8 Pacific time. Our guest tonight on our second hour was Rich Tellman. He is the Director of Research and Exploration with Fossil Fuel Discoveries, and his website is www.zazzle, that's Z-A-Z-Z-L-E, /thefossilfields.com. And he's got several YouTube videos out there. He really cares about his work, and I think he did a good job here tonight. Also, don't forget Remembering the Future. The ebook is now out. I know if you're not a big ebook fan, I think you'll enjoy this one. It's about 200 pages. At least you get to see the pictures in color. That's the important part. There are a lot of photos, a lot of drawings in the book that are much better in color. When it comes out in print, those will be in black and white. The ebook's only $7.95. It will give you 25% off the printed version when it comes out in about 50 days. Then you'll have the autographed version of the book on your shelf, and the knowledge in your head, and you'll also have the reference material to go back to. To get a copy of it instantly, go to rememberingthefuturebook.com remembering the future book.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. After that, we'll have it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the other outlets so that you can get your hands on the printed version. Those of you that buy the ebook, you're going to get an autographed version, and that's part of our benefit to you. Also, don't forget about the Ark of Millions of Years series. This is about 1,500 pages, almost 500 photographs and drawings taken from all over the world. The whole 2012 end times mystery unraveled from beginning to, well, I was going to say the end, but maybe it's the beginning to the beginning. You can get your copy at arkofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K like Noah's Ark, arkofmillionsofyears.com. You get the trilogy autographed, and you get the first two books in audio, over 40 hours of recording. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you. And you'll get those instantly while you're waiting for the book to come in the mail. And you'll have the trilogy, whether it's available in paperback and hardback, on its way, free shipping as a trilogy. We appreciate you being here and being a part of X Squared Radio. And we will see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.